Hi guys, welcome back to part two of the Van Thuong Nguyen story on Unknown Passage, a podcast that tells the stories of those who have gone missing or have been murdered abroad. So if you haven't listened to part one, I suggest going and listening to that because you have to get all the information of Van, who he is, and pretty much the lead up to his arrest in Changi Airport, Singapore. Yeah, I don't really have anything else to say. I don't think I said on the previous episode that I have a new patron, Neil. I don't know if I've said that already, so I'm saying it now. I think I did. Actually, I did. So you're getting two, Neil. So I just want to correct myself on one thing. When I read back over the verdict that they gave, which is the document from the government of Singapore that you can read online. I will put it on Van's episode page on Unknown Passage podcast when I put this up live. He had a girlfriend called Amira. She is in the series, and I didn't think that he actually had one because she's rarely referenced like anywhere, but she's referenced on a line of the his confession, which is part of the whole ruling that you can read. And I'm going to read you bits of that confession in this episode, but he basically only references her when he says that during his layover before trying to board the plane from Singapore to Melbourne, he got a calling card and rang her. So she actually is a real person. So where we left off, Van was arrested and he was taken into a room at the airport. And when they basically discovered the first brick on him when he was patted down after passing through security, trying to board his plane from Singapore to Melbourne, he did pretty much up front say that he had it and he knew what it was, because one of the men who was in the room with him, one of the guards, asked him if he what it was. And he said, "It's heroin, sir," and gave up the second bag that was basically strapped to his shoulder, on his back, I believe. Because that's how they make it look anyway. So when he was given the two bricks in Cambodia, he was basically told never to mix them. I think they're two different qualities. But basically all of this heroin really wasn't worth a whole lot in Australia from what I can read. But that was where he was bringing it. And heroin actually is expensive in Australia, and cocaine, because we're an island where it's not created and bought over borders. So he gave up the name Sun very quickly, but he didn't know who this guy was. And I was really shocked by how little actual coverage there is of Van's case. It was just really recapping tiny things. There's really no one other than documentaries that have been made and the series where it goes into a lot about Van. So really the most you get is like from his confession and from that. And a lot of it, it's really hard to confirm. I've tried to find like what happened to the guy who organized him to go to meet Sun, and I literally can't find anything. But yeah, so according to his confession, Van was given a urine test, and when he did it, it came back negative. And he says in his confession that that really surprised him because he was forced to smoke the heroin and he had no idea how long it stayed in your system. And that would have really surprised me too, because it was literally like a day or two after, and I thought it had quite a long, you know, half-life. So this is where we're going to get into the case of Singapore versus Van Nguyen, because he was charged with the Misuse of Drugs Act, which I'll be getting into. But what I want to do is I want to read you part of their document, which is his confession, and then it lays down why he's being sentenced and what he did. And basically it's the documentation that was submitted from the Singapore government as part of the ruling on his appeal, which happened, you know, you get an automatic appeal on death row, but honestly, like, no one comes off death row once they're sentenced. So I'm going to read you some of what Van says happened from then. Quote, "There was a phone number which I could recall being used by the syndicate on the day that I left Sydney for Singapore. That was on the 3rd of December 2002 while I was at the Pacific International Hotel in Sydney. I called them at this number and they told me to listen to the message. Then I received a message on my handphone. I could not remember if it was the Nokia handphone or the Siemens handphone. The message stated, 'Checked out now.' The number is..." I'm not going to read the number in case it's been given to someone else. "It is a handphone number and it starts with 04. I do not know who the owner of that mobile number of handphone. However, it must be connected to Sun. Besides this number, all the other numbers stored inside the two handphones that were seized from me were my friends, and they have nothing to do with this case. 38. The Sony laptop that was seized from me belonged to my good friend, whom I know as Barry. He's an Indonesian, aged about 20 years old. He's currently studying in Melbourne. I do not know his real name, as it was too long to remember and too complicated to pronounce. Barry has no criminal records. I borrowed the laptop from him on the 1st of December 2002, just before I left for Sydney, to keep myself entertained while I was on this trip. I also wanted to use it to write letters. I did not use it to record any event that was connected to this case. I hope that Barry got his laptop back. 39. There were a total of 9 watches found in my luggage. Only one is genuine, and that is the black colour Man Rado watch, which I bought for $2,500 back in Melbourne. Just Felicity again. If he's buying a watch for that much and he's in trouble, I think a lot of Van's problems were him. Back to the quote. I used my savings to purchase it on my 21st birthday about 1 year and 3 months ago. The other 8 fake watches were bought in Phnom Penh on the 6th of December 2002. I intended to give them to my friends in Australia as Christmas gifts. The 10 belts found inside my luggage were for the same purpose. They cost about 508 Australian dollars and I used my own savings to buy them. 40. The amount of cash that was recovered from me comprised of Cambodia, Vietnam, Australia, Singapore, and US currency. The total value would not exceed $100. They were left over from the US $1,000 given to me by Sun. Sun gave me US $1,000 for my hotel, food, transport, and entertainment purposes for this trip. He handed the money together with the air tickets before I left Sydney for Singapore on the 2nd of December 2002. So basically, he's going over what they took from him, and he borrowed a laptop from a friend. But when he was in Phnom Penh, he'd bought a bunch of like fake Rolexes to give to his friends back in Melbourne for Christmas presents. He goes over the one that is his from his 21st birthday, and he'd also bought 10 belts that cost him about $500 US, which I just want to say he had US dollars because the currency in Cambodia, they do have a local currency, but actually they just accept US dollars. So that's what they use there. And he's just talking about what Sun gave him to spend, you know, which I honestly think that was all Sun was going to give him. I don't think he was ever going to get his money. You know, what was going to force them to give him his money at the end of all this if he'd got back to Australia? So Van confessed to having in his possession 396.2 grams of heroin, which is more than 26 times the amount of heroin that mandates a death sentence under the Misuse of Drugs Act in Singapore. So I'm going to read you what the Misuse of Drugs Act is and what constitutes a mandatory death penalty. So the Misuse of Drugs Act, under Schedule 2 of it, any person importing or exporting more than the following quantities of drugs receives a mandatory death sentence. So it's 1,200 grams of opium, 30 grams of morphine, 15 grams of diamorphine, which is heroin, which is what Van had, 30 grams of cocaine, 500 grams of cannabis, 1,000 grams of cannabis mixture, 200 grams of cannabis resin, 250 grams of methamphetamine. Death penalties also apply to people caught manufacturing this within Singapore as well. Anything under that is considered possession. So there's very small amounts of certain things. Only half a kilogram of cannabis can ultimately get you the death penalty, which applies for marijuana in other countries as well. So now I'm going to talk about Van's legal team, who I'm not going to kind of go what happened in the series, just in case you guys watch it. A lot of it isn't kind of spot on. We don't know what their private conversations were, but ultimately Van's legal team was a Melbourne Queen's Counsel, which is QC, extremely highly paid lawyers. I don't know what the, it's almost like as close to a magistrate. They're paid about $600 an hour in Australia. This man's name is Lex Lazary, and he's played by Brian Brown in the series Better Man. And his barrister, who became an extremely close member of the Nguyen family, is a man named Julian McMahon. Now, you may know that there's another Australian actor called Julian McMahon, who was in Home and Away, and then he was married to Danny Minogue, and then he was in the show Nip Tuck, which is one of my favourite shows. Also the son of an Australian Prime Minister way back in the day. Julian McMahon, this is a different one. So Lex Lazary and Julian McMahon worked pro bono. They didn't accept a cent for representing Van. And Julian McMahon is a barrister. He has dream-like experience in Southeast Asian cases. He has worked not only for Van Nguyen, but for the Bali Nine, who I mentioned on a previous episode. He is very anti-death penalty, and he has been awarded the Australian of the Year Award in 2016. Ultimately, he did end up getting Australia to co-sign on a movement a number of years ago to end the death penalty around the globe, but I think that would be an extremely hard thing to do. So Lex and Julian ultimately travelled from Melbourne to Singapore so many times throughout the 2 years that they represented Van. They also had quite a good Singaporean anti-death penalty, barrister over there. But, you know, most barristers are pro-death penalty because they toe the government line. I presume it's probably true, but in the series they had one who was the only anti-death penalty, you know, lawyer in Singapore, and he ended up dying when he visited Melbourne to meet with the team, and I presume that is true. So they ended up getting another one, pretty much the only one they could find, and I presume there's an element of truth to this, but in the series Better Man, they have a higher up basically confront him and tell him if he takes this case, his career in Singapore and his future will be ruined, but he takes it anyway. Now, in a letter to David Hawker, the Speaker of the Australian House of Representatives, in a letter to David Hawker, who was the Australian Speaker of the House of Representatives, a man named Abdullah Tamugi, who was the Speaker of the Parliament of Singapore, wrote to him in response to a letter that basically said, asking not to have him be given the death penalty. Quote, he was caught in possession of almost 400 grams of pure heroin, enough for more than 26,000 doses of heroin for drug addicts. He knew what he was doing and the consequences of his actions. As representatives of the people, we have an obligation to protect the lives of those who could be ruined by the drugs he was carrying, unquote. And I'll talk a little bit about my feelings on that in a bit. Singapore's High Commissioner in Australia, his name was Joseph Koh, he said, quote, Singapore cannot afford to pull back from its tough drug trafficking position, unquote. And the thing is, if they were to give him a lighter sentence or later on to give him clemency, it sets almost a precedent for their laws to be changed in regards to this. And they've built this up for a very long time, their zero tolerance policy. In a survey done by the Straits Times, which is one of the leading newspapers in Southeast Asia, in 2005, 95% of Singaporean respondents believed that Singapore should keep the death penalty. So according to those odds, Singaporeans, you know, are backing the death penalty for their country. And I'm sure that's probably true because I really think they like didn't want people bringing in drugs to this clean, drug-free country. The death penalty is a deterrent, seemingly, according to the statistics. In the early 90s, there were up to 100 hangings a year. I was looking at each year's stats. Recent years, there have been zero hangings some years, two some years. So it really has, I think, these stories deterred people who were maybe considering doing it. The Singaporean government released figures that showed between 1993 and 2003, 36% of death row inmates executed in Singapore were foreigners. And this includes, as I said, Singapore is a very multicultural country. A lot of them are considered foreigners. So it's a large majority that actually aren't born and raised in Singapore. 70% of hangings in Singapore are for drug-related offences under the Misuse of Drugs Act, which I just read to you. I was going through basically looking at different people who had been given clemency from the president, and a couple of them were murderers. There's only been a few who at the last minute have been given clemency. A few of them were drug dealers, and I noticed that the common thing with them is that they were women. So maybe they believe that women can be rehabilitated easier. I don't know. In Singapore, other mandatory death penalty other Singapore mandatory death penalty things that you can do, murder, attempted murder, robbery, more than five people robbing somewhere. It's all very strange because I didn't think attempted murder could get you a death penalty. It would have to be like a lock, stock case. Ultimately, the Singaporean High Court sentenced Van on the 20th of March 2004 to death for the crime of basically transiting through Singapore in the airport without ever leaving to death, which is one of the things that later on their lawyers would try to use against for an appeal by saying that he was never going to leave the airport. This was not destined for Singaporean people. It was actually destined for Australian people. So he should be charged in Australia. They tried a lot of things, which I will get into. And after he was convicted, Van was moved to death row in the notorious Changi prison in Singapore. So an Australian kind of his friend started this campaign where Van had basically outlined his hand on a piece of paper, and they ended up using this outline to have people print it off and write their own message to Van to support him and send it through to the team. And they had submissions from all over the world, which is something that the series shows very well. And after he was sentenced to death, anti-death penalty advocates across the world were appalled, you know, including a lot of, you know, lawyers. I've seen articles about Van in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Irish Times, the LA Times. So it got, you know, a lot of attention. But I do want to say that I have looked, you know, when you're watching something on YouTube, I don't know if it's just me, but I always scroll through comments. And I'm really yet to see someone who hasn't written he got what he deserved because he knew what was going to happen if he did it, or what a dumbass, or why the fuck would he do that? Most people, I think people who do this are kind of get what they asked for or get what they deserve. So, I mean, I can't really argue in this. I'm not for or against the death penalty. I don't know about with drugs. I will talk about my own experience later, but I think with certain murders, I think people deserve it. There's certain murders that I've read about where I would love to be front row center to watch them, you know, fry. but with drugs, you know, I'm not really sure, but drugs can destroy people's lives. And I will talk about that, you know, later, especially heroin. But right now I'm going to talk about Changi Prison. So there's very few prisons, maybe other than Alcatraz. By the way, last podcast on the left, it had just finished a series on Alcatraz and it was so good. You should go and listen to it. There's very few prisons that are known by their name that are so notorious to people across the world. And Changi Prison is one of them in Singapore. Australians, Brits mostly will instantly think of the treatment of Australian and British prisoners of war at the then Changi Prisoner of War camp during the Second World War. It's called Changi Prison because the Changi Peninsula is where the really big 25 square kilometre camp stood. But let's go back a bit. So due to overcrowding in other prisons, Changi was built and opened in 1936, so about 3 years before the Second World War started. During World War II, when Singapore was under Japanese rule, which I talked about in part one, Changi was converted into a prisoner of war camp. And because essentially there were two world wars going on, there was the war in the Pacific that mostly involved Australia, the US for a little time, Japan. And then there was the war in Europe with the Holocaust, with Hitler and Europe. Changi was ultimately converted into a prisoner of war camp because Australians, and they're the vast majority, so I will just say Australians, were being captured in the Pacific and, you know, sent to prisoner of war camps under horrible, horrible circumstances. And those captured in Singapore were held here before a lot of them were moved on. Anyone over the rank of colonel was sent to Taiwan for a prisoner of war camp. So Lieutenant Colonel Frederick Blackjack Galligan was tasked with being the commander of the Aussie POWs in Changi. Despite the fact that they were POWs, he continued to train them because he thought if he trained them unarmed combat, they could potentially uprise against their Japanese captors and free themselves from Changi. But it was actually said when I was reading on the Australian War Memorial website that his men actually feared him more than the Japanese guards because he was so scary. A famous name that Australians will know who passed through Changi for a time was Weary Dunlop. In February 1942, The Japanese military detained around 3,000 civilians in Changi Prison. Changi Prison was only built to house about a fifth of that number, so there was severe overcrowding. And ultimately, they used another barracks, which was the British Army's Selarang Barracks, which is near Changi, as a prisoner of war camp as well. And this one held around 50,000 Allied soldiers, most of them Australian and British. Initially, the Japanese kind of let the Aussie POWs do whatever they wanted in the prison. It was kind of a massive prison. It was around 25 square kilometres. It was pretty much the entire Changi area because there's a village and it's part of the peninsula. But these days, as I'll talk about, the prison is just, you know, a portion of that. But it did happen in this area. But by 1942, the Japanese really changed their tune. The Australians kind of have the best reputations across the world for their behaviour in war. They're called the Diggers, and pretty much like the Brits, you know, the New Zealanders, the Canadians and the Allies, they really have a lot of respect for the Australians. And just a couple of days ago was Anzac Day, which I talked about on a previous episode. And that, well, it's technically to mark the Gallipoli landing by Australians in Turkey on the Gallipoli beach, where they were all basically gunned down and slaughtered as they ran towards, you know, Europe. But these days, Remembrance Day and Anzac Day is really just to commemorate Australian and New Zealand soldiers who have fought and served, you know, and both of my grandfathers did, although luckily neither of them were. Actually, my dad's dad was basically in the Indonesia Philippines area, and he was mentioned in the dispatches, which is a really big achievement. My other grandfather was stationed in Darwin in Australia when that was bombed by the Japanese as well. So if you've got a grandfather who hates the Japanese, don't, you know, hate him because you think he's a racist. The Japanese treated prisoners of war in the worst possible ways. They would rip their fingernails out, stick bamboo up their fingernails. The way that they treated them really left those generations hating them forever. And if you'd kind of seen the things that they saw, you would understand why. But these days, the Japanese are, you know, you consider them gentle people. The mood of the Japanese changed for the worse when a Australian POW tried to escape Changi Prison. And the Japanese responded to this not by beating or, you know, the prisoners of war were already starving anyway, but they basically demanded that everyone in the camp, Australians and Brits, sign this document that said not one of them would try to escape. Now, this was refused by every single soldier. And as a result of that, the Japanese put 20,000 POWs into a tiny little barracks and told them that they would not let them out until they signed the document. They said, "We are not signing the document." And when this didn't, you know, fix it and get it signed, the Japanese marched a number of POWs onto a local beach and shot them dead. And despite this, Australians did not sign that document. It was only when there was an epidemic of dysentery that spread through Changi Prison that they decided to sign it, because basically the Japanese would hold back vital medication if they didn't sign it. The men, I'm going to put a few pictures on Patreon for patrons, but basically the men, I can't even explain the pictures. They're just skeletons. I can't even explain it. The Japanese used the POWs at Changi for forced labour. They would pay them like 30 cents a day, but I was reading that I think it was a pack of cigarettes or something really small cost $30. So they made it so there was no way you could buy anything. I'll get to that shortly. Basically, if you worked and you were forced to work hard, you would get food, although very basic food. If you did not work, you would get no food. Men were forced to work in the docks, clean sewers, and basically a lot of them were so ill from dysentery, all of these different things because of overcrowding, poor sanitation, probably cholera. They basically relied on other men to be able to work in order to give them food. And the Australian way is that they did that. However, many prisoners were moved on from Changi, and Changi would look like a dream to them because they were moved on to labour camps outside Singapore. One of those, which one day I will cover, is the Burma-Thailand Railroad, which many people died building that. In 1943, there were 7,000 men left, and they were moved. Sorry, they were left at the British Selarang Barracks, and they were moved over to Changi. By this point, Changi was completely crammed with about, it was built to hold 1,000 people, and by this point, there was over like 10,000 POWs there, and a one man cell was holding about 5 or 6 men. The risk of disease spreading was huge and people were really sick. This was, you know, the war wouldn't end for another couple of years. The men basically started making up ways to make money and lie to the Japanese in order to get money to buy things, because you could earn money to buy things as a POW in Changi. So they basically, the army medics from the Australian Army, they made like these fake tablets, and VD, which is venereal disease, which syphilis and gonorrhea all fall under the umbrella of that. That was rampant throughout wars because they were having sex with women from these Asian areas and other areas where VD was spreading, all with prostitutes. And so VD was a common thing, and ultimately like end-stage syphilis, and that is really, really bad. There's a really good episode of The Dollop that talks about the history of syphilis, and it is terrifying. Like, your entire face ends up falling off. So this was a big thing. And basically these Australian army medics that made these fake tablets, they convinced the Japanese guards at Changi that these tablets were a cure for VD. They were like this new medication that was an instant cure. So they were able to sell these fake tablets to the Japanese guards, who thought that they'd be cured of VD, but too fucking bad. They would then buy actual proper medication for their sick men in Changi in an attempt to aid those who were sick. And that's kind of what Australians are known for in war. About 850 POWs died in Changi during the war, which is actually a small number in comparison to, say, the Burma-Thailand Railroad. Men were starved to the point of being skeletons. They got malaria, they got dysentery, and a lot of those things in that situation are a death sentence, because my dad's had malaria and he almost died, and that wasn't in a POW camp. Australians actually built a chapel. So for those in Canberra, the Australian Military College at Duntroon actually got that chapel and rebuilt it in Australia, and it's on display. So if you have seen it, like, let me know, because I have been to Canberra but not to the Australian Military College. And the last thing I want to say on the POWs in Changi is, and I got angry when I wrote this sentence, do you know what? In the photos, and you can look them up and I'll put a few in Patreon, the men, despite probably weighing maybe 30 kilos each, probably, you know, 25 pounds each, they are all smiling. There is a picture of them sipping their cups of tea, smoking their cigarettes and reading the paper, smiling. And most of them, they had smiles on their faces. And people who are offended by frozen yogurt should probably fucking have a look at those things and, you know, fix what's wrong with their brain. So now, ultimately, Changi Prison was liberated and the tables turned, because it now held Japanese guards who were being charged with war crimes, and they would execute them, you know, right where they had ultimately starved and tortured and beat Allied forces. Modern day Changi now holds the worst offenders in Singapore. It's called Changi Prison Complex. It's mostly long sentences, and death row is housed there. They also do caning at Changi. A former employee of the prison was quoted in 1995 as saying, quote, "Caning sessions at Changi are held twice per week. They are flogging more and more these days. Before, they are doing maybe 60 on Tuesdays and Fridays. Now they're doing 100, unquote. So if you're interested in the history of Changi with the PO Wars, there is an Australian series that I've heard of, but I have not watched, but I want to, called Changi from 2001. Now, modern day Changi is a modern complex. It's not like the slum prisons of Bali, like Karabakan prison, or what the guys were in Malaysia, Kevin and Brian. It is indoors where you get a little bit of outdoor time, 30 minutes a day. Death row is pretty much solitary isolation in a cold cell. I haven't heard a lot about mistreatment in Changi. There is a uniform that they wear, which is a white t-shirt and blue shorts, but you are able to have visitors. You are able to do video calls once in a while, and it's pretty much run, you know, as a Buddhist prison, which isn't the worst thing on earth. Inmates aren't allowed things like TVs, radios, personal clothes. When you're in your cell, you're not sitting there watching TV like a lot of them in America or Australia. They're not even allowed to keep a pen and paper with them. But I was reading this article called A Day in the Life of Changi Prison on yp.sg, and it was a prisoner who basically said what a day in the life was like, and he wasn't on death row, so I think this is a privilege reserved for people who are there for like a year or a couple of years or something that isn't so serious. But he basically said that you get given tablets like an iPad to inmates for 90 minutes every night so they can play games on it, read their ebooks, or write letters via the prison email portal. So that's pretty amazing. On top of weekly visits that they're allowed from friends and family, there's also a televisit room in Changi where they're allowed to have a 30-minute video call with people who can't actually make it to Changi prison. And there is also a Changi women's prison and drug rehabilitation center as well. So I hope that you've learned a little bit about Singapore and Changi on this. So let's get into Van's appeal. So Van was entitled to a automatic appeal because he was put on death row, which is what I think most countries agree to. The defense worked on a number of different things. And one of them, which is in the show, is that on the appeal, they said that when the heroin was seized and it was first weighed, later on that day, they weighed it again and it weighed slightly less, like 20 grams less. I think this wasn't going to get Van off even if they proved it, but what they were trying to do was kind of introduce doubt into the case that something was up. So I don't know why, but I'm going to play you a little bit of the clip from the show, because as much as people say, you know, a lot of it's fake, this is actually what Brian Brown and David Wenham, are talking about in this clip, are basically ways that they can appeal and brainstorming ways to get Van out. So here you go.
Okay, what do we got? We've got, there's his youth. He's only 22 years of age. Immaturity. Naivety. Lack of life experience. Easily manipulated.
Vulnerability. The one thing the traffickers prey on when grooming their mules. Which brings us to point number two. Personal and family circumstances. A refugee. Single mother with no extended family. Dysfunctional upbringing, stepfather he hardly even knew.
Financial disadvantage. Family struggling to make ends meet. Compounded by the debt from legal bills and pressure from loans they couldn't hope to repay.
Even so, no priors or misdemeanors. In fact, the sheer ineptitude of his trying to conceal the drugs and his pathetic attempt at playing out his role as a courier clearly demonstrate that he is no pro. But he has shown remorse and he's cooperating with authorities, and hopefully his intel will be of use to the AFP.
Also, I just want to say that the Australian Federal Police were involved on the Australian end because he was trying to traffic drugs into Australia, you know, as a courier working for someone else. And actually, the day that he was arrested, the Australian Federal Police like turned up in droves to Kim's house. She thought he was like on a holiday in Southeast Asia, visiting where she was from, probably Vietnam. But they just turned up and made their way into the house, basically tossing the whole house to find drugs, which I think probably would have come as quite a shock to her. So I just played you that clip from the show, but those are all the reasons why they were trying to overturn the conviction of the death penalty. Basically, they were trying anything to even get Van onto a life sentence because they can keep him alive and there's always hope. Where there's life, there's hope. when he's dead, they can't do anything about it. They also worked on the fact that Singapore had breached the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. This is basically a convention treaty where a lot of different countries have signed on that pretty much allows you your rights in another country. Say if you were arrested and you are entitled to have access to the embassy pretty much immediately, for instance. But the Australian consulate didn't have access to Van, according to Australia, for pretty much like a whole day of 24 hours after he was arrested. In the verdict, Singapore versus, you know, Van Nguyen, basically, it says how Singapore rejects this. They pretty much say that this is all bullshit and they did have access to it. Singapore is not a signatory to the convention, but according to the Australian argument from the defence, they should have been bound to it, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Singapore's argument is pretty simple that they're not a signatory to it, so he's not entitled to those rights while he's abroad. Basically, his prosecution's argument was against it wasn't a breach of it, but also they managed to dismiss the differentiation in weight as well, which in the series they say when that gets handed down that they're dismissing that and it's being upheld. Brian Brown and David Wenham are pretty much like, what the fuck? Like in any other first world country, the whole case would have been thrown out. They were looking for the whole case to be dismissed on that one thing, which actually it would have been in any other country on that technicality. But in Singapore, it was not. That's how it's written though. That's how I've written it. So the Court of Appeal rejected this on the 20th of October, 2004. And generally, when you're on death row, for instance, in the states that have it, you are on death row for a very long time, like 10, 20, sometimes even 30 years. In Singapore, once that appeal is rejected, it seems that you're pretty much dead within a year, which is pretty scary. Ultimately, his team, Lex and Julian, would ultimately make a last-ditch attempt to file charges against Van in Australia, which is a very clever idea. Basically, they were saying the drugs were intended for Australia, so they were never going to go into Singapore. So their argument was the charges should apply to him in Australia, which means he should be extradited. But ultimately, the police couldn't do this because they said it would mean double jeopardy. It would mean that he was not only charged both and found convicted and found guilty in Singapore, but he would also, you know, have that happen in Australia, which kind of defeats his human rights in like a twisted kind of sad way. So that was one idea they had. And they lodged this a day before his execution. So they were working right up to the 11th hour on this. Towards the end, they even wanted to file a complaint with the International Court of Justice, which would have delayed all this. That's in The Hague. But ultimately, Singapore has to sign on for this as well in another really twisted way. So they weren't able to do this. And the very final thing you can do when you're on death row, which you will probably remember from the movie Brokedown Palace, if you remember it, in these countries, you can appeal for clemency. And it's usually either to the president, the prime minister, or the king, I think in Thailand. They lodged this to the president of Singapore, which is who handles appeals for clemency, which is illustrated in the series. And it's true that the president, as I said earlier, is just a figurehead. So it would really only work if he appealed to the prime minister, but this isn't allowed. So it's like sending like a letter to someone who can't do anything anyway. And ultimately nothing worked. Van's family received a letter from Singapore Prisons Department just a couple of weeks before he was to be hung to his death, notifying of the date for his hanging and the time. And hangings in Singapore always happen at dawn, 6 a.m. And I think that's in most places in the world. And I wonder why that is. His hanging was scheduled for the 2nd of December, 2005. And it's such a strange thing in that instance to know exactly when you will die. Blows my mind. Australian Prime Minister, he was then the Prime Minister, John Howard, who he'll come up in another case I'll be doing because I want to do the Port Arthur massacre. He made a last ditch attempt on Van's behalf to the Singaporean Prime Minister, I think, who was visiting Australia pretty much like a couple of weeks before this. I think he was traveling the world because I've got a clip from him coming up. The Prime Minister at the time in Singapore was Lee Hsien Loong. However, by the time John Howard did this, the letter with the date on it had already been delivered to Van's mother. So she was organising to go to Singapore for the final time. She went back and forth so many times for her son to Singapore. It's about 7 hours flight from Melbourne, but it's expensive. I don't know who was paying for these flights, but it just shows like a mother's love. The legal team went back and forth so many times over a couple of years. John Howard ultimately said he was quote unquote very disappointed that he was not informed of the execution date before it was publicised. Van's lawyers, Lex and Julian, arrived in Singapore on the 18th of November 2005 to inform Van that the date was set and he was going to die. And at this point, they had no other legal avenues. This is it. You've tried clemency. You've tried the international court. You've tried all these technicalities with Australian police. You've tried, you know, the appeals process. And at this point, that's it. Like, there's no other way unless he, like, kills himself in custody. Now, even two popes, which were John Paul II and Pope Benedict, spoke on behalf to save Van's life, which has never really happened before. Of course, they're going to say that because they're Catholics, but wasn't Benedict a Nazi? So the night before his death, Van saw his mother for the last time. He saw his team the day before he died. He had a visit with his mum, and his brother went to visit him. Now, contact visits aren't allowed in the Singaporean system, but he was quite popular within the prison with the guards and the prison warden. So they kind of relaxed the rules to allow some physical contact. He hadn't touched anybody from his family or his friends during all of these, pretty much for like 3 years. And in this one, they were allowed to kind of hold hands. They said it was limited contact. So I think it was actually, like they represent in the series Better Man, a kind of slot that was opened in their glass kind of visitor room. And his mum was able to stroke his face, hold his hands, and, you know, touch his hair. The prison guards at Changi were very fond of Van. And the night before his execution, they actually bought him like some chocolates and a bag of food for him. Julian McMahon said, quote, "They're going to be very upset. They work in death row on the ground and they feel it. Van and these men have a great relationship, and I've seen evidence of it. Yesterday, a couple of prison officers arrived with a bag of food for him, which was chocolates and these sort of things. That's the way they try to bestow some sort of privileges on him," unquote. So it must be such a crazy job to work on death row and know that if you form some sort of relationship, they'll be gone soon, or know that none of these people are permanent there, and kind of trying not to get, you know, too involved with them, too on their side, but still trying to show some humanity. It must be crazy. But basically, I'm going to play you a clip from Julian McMahon, who was speaking outside the prison to the press, I think once he'd said goodbye to Van for the last time, and Van kind of thanked him for, you know, all he had done. And he was basically saying that Van was trying to remain optimistic, and he was really trying to go with his head held high. So I'm going to play you that now.
What I wish to say is that he is cheerful because he's composed. He only wishes to think good thoughts, say good thoughts, do what is right. He is completely rehabilitated, completely reformed, completely focused on doing what is good, and now they're going to kill him. Thank you.
Thank you.
So his lawyer's clearly struggling to find words at that point after his final visit with Van, who he'd you know, spent his entire career on for the past couple of years and got to know, like, on a personal level. Although that video, if you look in the comments, it's on the AP archive YouTube. You'd be hard pressed to find like a sympathetic comment because, for instance, here's one, and he's completely reformed and now they're going to kill him. Geez, I wonder why. He reformed too late. He would have got executed if he reformed and stopped trafficking drugs. He knows the penalty for trafficking in Singapore is death, but he chose to do it. Those are some mistakes that are not tolerated. Why do they always say he's reformed when they are behind bars? They have no choice. Does lawyer ever get anyone off? Sorry, mate, he reformed too late. He should have reformed prior to trafficking. The stupid irony is that one of his motivations for drug smuggling was to pay his twin brother's court fees to drug offences. In other words, he planned to ruin the lives of others so that his brother wouldn't be accountable for his own drug use. And that comment kind of brings me to my feelings. When I was watching the series, it suddenly hit me around episode 2. This guy trafficked and smuggled heroin, much of it in Melbourne. This hits me on a personal level. That heroin most likely would have been my brother's or got to my brother. And he's trying to pay the legal fees of his brother Kwa, who is a reformed heroin addict, by bringing this deadly drug that is illegal for a reason through the Golden Triangle. He's picked it up and then smuggling it through to Australia. And it sounds harsh, but around episode 2, I stopped having much feelings towards Van because it hit me on such a personal level. The number of addicts in Melbourne I have met, how that drug that he was bringing in would have been another score for my brother, for his best friend, who's also an addict, for his ex-girlfriend who recently died from an overdose about 2 months ago. And I really, it just hit me hard to the point where I had to pause it and go and make a cup of tea because I realized just how much this is like would have affected someone I probably knew. And I really couldn't bring myself to have much emotion for it other than the fact it's a loss of a young man who should have given his life to something else, who could have found a way out of this, who turned to the drug that was destroying his entire family. So as this person in this comment said, the minute I read it, it just clicked. They're trying to destroy another person's family by not holding his brother accountable, and that other person's family is mine. So that's why this case is so important to me, because I know firsthand the violence I've seen, the number of police visits I grew up with at my home, the way that it has aged my mother. I have seen my brother almost have his arm amputated from an infected track mark, which caused basically his entire arm to rot, like Requiem for a Dream. I have had my family not offer me support because both my drug addict brothers had been basically consuming all of their time, as my mother now kind of acknowledges. I'm sorry, but yeah, I just started getting really angry when I talked about that. So with that kind of being said, the Prime Minister of Singapore, the day before Van was executed, was in Germany speaking with Angela Merkel at something, and someone had asked him from the journalists, you know, his thoughts on Van's coming impending execution. And I'm just going to play you what the Prime Minister said.
This was not a matter discussed between the Chancellor and me. It's a Singapore issue. We have stated our position clearly that we take a very serious view of drug trafficking. The penalty is death. In this case, it was an enormous amount of drugs which were being trafficked. It's nearly 400 grams of pure heroin, which is equivalent to 26,000 doses of heroin. I mean, they do it shot by shot, which means untold misery and suffering to hundreds, if not thousands, of addicts and their families. The man was charged, convicted, appealed, dismissed. He put up a clemency petition. The petition was considered. All factors were taken into account, including petitions and letters from Australian leaders. Finally, the government decided that the law had to take its course, and the law will have to take its course.
Now, I hope you heard that, because that's right. 26,000 average doses of heroin is what Van was bringing in. And pretty much when I found that clip earlier today, that was my last shred of sympathy. Because when the Prime Minister says that would cause untold misery to thousands, you know, of addicts and their families, my family is one of them that he's talking about. So I'm sorry if you wanted me to be sympathetic. I know most of you aren't. I have had on my YouTube people arguing when I put up the preview of the Barlow and Chambers episode. A guy pretty much wrote how fucking dumb drug addicts are and why there needs to be an argument at all. I mean, there does need to be an argument, but since then he's been having a massive fight that's ongoing with another guy who's anti-death penalty. And as a result, there's been like 3,000 views of it or something like that. But so now I'm going to bring you to the execution and put my own feelings aside. Van Nguyen had spent a sleepless final night on death row, and he was reciting his favourite psalm, the 23rd psalm, with a chaplain who they have access to on death row. His lawyer said that he loved the 21st psalm, quote, "He's determined to go out with strength and optimism." I think I just said the 21st psalm. It's the 23rd, and I read it. It's the "I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil" one, which I always try to go into the coolio when I'm trying to say it. I read that at my mum's dad's, my grandfather's funeral. Van's cell walls were covered in photos of his loved ones and his drawings. And basically, he didn't sleep the night before, obviously. Now, as he was preparing to leave his cell before dawn to be hung, he turned to the guards who were escorting him out of his room on the 2nd of December 2005, and he said to them jokingly, "Do I have a chance?" Which is something that kind of made them laugh a little bit because they'd all become quite close to him. This is said in this kind of prison slang Malay way. It's "bu chance bu." I probably sounded really dumb saying that. Julian McMahon said, quote, "One of the most endearing things about Van in the last year of his life and perhaps in the last few weeks was his capacity to be cheerful and witty. He thought it would be very funny if he said that to his guards just as he began his 45-second walk from his cell to the gallows," unquote. It's literally a 45-second walk because it's literally right near death row where the gallows are. So you would just walk around, you know, the corner, and there's no word of Van's legs buckling under him or something like that. Mine would have. They would be dragging me there. As Van was walked to the gallows with the black hood over his head, his fellow prisoners sang hymns to him. And they can't see each other, but they could kind of call out to each other on death row. And I think he talked to quite a number of them. His mother prayed throughout the night until dawn at a chapel in Singapore, up until the time that he was hung at 6 a.m. And Kwa, his brother, and his friends Callie and Bronwyn, who came over from Australia, waited in prison reception until after he was killed, kind of to be physically close to him. A vigil ran in the nearby Changi village from midnight until 6 a.m. And on the 2nd of December 2005, Van was executed at 6:06 a.m. The last rites were performed, the trapdoor opened, and Van Nguyen swung to his death. Singapore uses the long drop method of hanging, which is apparently the most merciful and quick. So you pretty much won't know from the time the trapdoor opens what happened to you. Van was officially reported as dead at 7:17 a.m. Singapore time by the Ministry of Home Affairs. And they said, quote, "The sentence was carried out this morning at Changi Prison." Van was the first Australian executed in Southeast Asia since 1993, so 12 years. 1993 was when Michael McAuliffe, who I mentioned in the Barlow and Chambers episode, he was also in their same prison in Malaysia, and he was killed for drug smuggling as well. He was also the last Australian to be executed overseas since 2005, but that was before 2015 when Andrew Chan and Muren Sukumaran from the Bali Nine were executed by firing squad in Indonesia, a case that I will do at some point when I have the energy after this one. A minor controversy occurred basically before the execution, because a hangman is basically picked out from a series of ones who are rotated through in Changi to do this. And there was one who was a contract hangman called Darshan Singh, who had basically done an interview with an Australian newspaper. And in it, he said he hoped he was called upon to do it and he would hang Van, quote unquote, efficiently. People were not happy with this. It's a bit of a vulgar thing for an Australian newspaper to publish. After the execution, Van's body was released to his family about 4 hours after he was hung, and there was a short service in Singapore for his family and friends, a private memorial. The media kind of allowed them, the family, to have this without filming them going to the chapel, because it's such a terrible day for them. Van Nguyen was always going to return to Melbourne in a coffin. As far as I'm concerned, there was no way he was going to win an appeal or get clemency. It was too high profile and he'd bought in way too much. And he did return to Melbourne in a coffin on the 4th of November 2005, just 2 days after he was hung to death. A mass was held at St. Patrick's Cathedral in the city, which is a very big church right in the city, on the 7th of December 2005. And those who attended wore white, which is the Vietnamese colour of mourning, which is such a nicer colour than black. I hate funerals where people have to wear black. I don't want people to do that at mine. It is so depressing. A number of Victorian members of Parliament attended the service. And basically the Crime Victims Support Association said that they shouldn't have, because it appeared to give support to a convicted drug trafficker. So their side was on the people that the heroin, you know, would have affected had it made it to Australia. But then again, it comes in all the time because they get it from somewhere. But you know, that's 26,000 less average injections of heroin entering Australia. The ABC broadcast a documentary called Just Punishment on the 7th of December 2006, about a year after Van was executed. And this is kind of the family's documentary where they followed his mum and his brother Qua and his friends through the appeals and that. Now, I can't get a copy of this. The ABC generally doesn't upload their things to YouTube. It really sucks. It was in 2006. So if anyone's got a copy of that, I'd like to see it. Really, it didn't affect Australian-Singaporean relations at all. Some airport, you know, baggage handlers refused to process Singapore Airlines luggage. There was only a few of them. John Howard basically said that the country would not take any action or apply any sanctions against Singapore, which a lot of anti-death penalty advocates were asking for. You really can't expect him to do that because, you know, this person knew what they were doing. It's unfortunate. Julian McMahon received the Victorian State Australian of the Year recipient award in 2016 and has continued his work for Australians locked up abroad, including the Bali Nine. It really hasn't saved any of them so far, as someone asked in the comments on that video. He's really just working with death penalty prisoners. And so far, Van, Andrew and Muren, who he has worked with, have all been executed, as have the Bali Nine cases and other drug smuggling cases in Australia. It continues to bring up this discussion about the death penalty. But as I see it, Australians cannot put pressure on another country to change its system. Can you imagine if Singapore tried to change our system, Australians who are listening? Or imagine China tried to change your system, USA? Or imagine some random little country like Bulgaria tried to change your system, UK? You just can't accept, you can't do that. You have to know that every country operates differently. And it's unfortunate, but that's why I like doing this podcast, because I like you guys learning about different countries, even just little things, how they operate, and know that each country is different. They're not all the same. And kind of the more I do this, the more I kind of tend to understand that, and I'm less sympathetic to the idea of putting pressure on another country to change something. You know that drug trafficking is a death penalty offence in Singapore. I know that. I've been to Singapore. I know that in Thailand. I've never done it as a result of knowing that. And most Australians who travel to these countries in their droves, because they're so popular, know that as well. So it's one person, and you can't change an entire system for one person. Basically, if they took clemency on Van at the last hour or allowed him to get off on his appeal or have it reduced to a life sentence, it would have changed the precedent for every other drug smuggling case after that. It would mean that someone could bring in a million kilos of something, and it would have changed the precedent for how the court operates. It would mean that that person who brought in a million kilos of heroin would possibly have a chance of getting out because the law was changed because of Van Nguyen. And, you know, with something like heroin, I can't be sympathetic. I wasn't particularly sympathetic on Kevin Barlow and Brian Chambers, and they actually had less to be sympathetic for as opposed to Van. Kevin and Brian literally did it because they wanted to make money. It wasn't for their families or to help their brothers or anything like that. It was for themselves. So Van at least was doing it for someone else. But as that person in that comment said, you're doing it for someone who was hooked on that drug. So in order to not let him, in order to let Kwa off the hook for his addiction, you're ruining other people's families. And that is the argument that means I can't be sympathetic, but I'm entitled to my opinion, as are you. And nothing really is going to take that away from me. He wasn't a kingpin. He was a literal mule. And I guarantee, as is with most cases, this person who's the mule, who's carrying such a small amount, it's usually a distraction from someone bringing an even bigger amount into the country, as kind of demonstrated in the movie Broke Down Palace. They're usually a distraction for the authorities for another mule to come through. And who knows, maybe that was the case, you know, with Van. Kwa has continued to blame himself on the Just Punishment documentary. He said, quote, "I continue to blame myself. I feel guilty that I did lots of bad things. I feel guilty that I influenced my brother in a bad way to do bad things," unquote. But in my estimation, as much as Kwa has his problems, it is not Kwa's fault. Van made his decisions. Even Kwa, to get himself out of his problems, did not go to Singapore and traffic drugs. I understand why he would blame himself, but he just can't. I'm not really sympathetic to him because he's made violent decisions in the past. I don't understand how someone can't get through their life without having multiple arrests. It blows my mind and really annoys me. Serial recidivists. And it's not the system, it's the person. Every time they pick up that spoon and heat up their heroin or whatever they do, that's a decision. I'm sorry for those who say it's a mental condition and stuff. It is a decision because I've watched it happen many, many times. My brother, you know how he got hooked on heroin? One day he was just bored and decided to do it because he'd done every other drug and he was bored. So he looked up a YouTube tutorial on how to inject it, how to tie up his arm, how to heat it up, how to do all that, and him and his friend did it. That was a literal choice. He wasn't forced to smoke it in a garage in Cambodia. He was sitting there bored because he was fucking unemployed and a loser. And I'm getting really heated, and this is the closest I've come to fucking screaming or crying on this as a result of my family's issues. But yeah, I can't say anymore. And no one can take my experience away from me. As dickheads who don't understand there's one truth say, my truth. There is one truth, and the truth is that he knew what he was doing. So I don't really have anything else to say. I am sorry if you're on drugs or whatever, but that's your experience and this is mine, and I don't really want feedback on how I should be sympathetic. It has been about 20 years of me dealing with my brother, my older brother at least's addiction. I have seen my younger brother break my mother's hand, dislocate her thumb, pull a knife on her, I've seen my older brother cut right across his palm with a knife. I have seen him do all kinds of drugs. I have seen him many times arrested by police. I have heard horror stories of things that he has done for money. I know that he has, you know, committed armed robbery, things like that, back in the past. And I have never done any of those things. And I think you should be able to get through your life without doing those things. We were not the richest growing up. We were not the poorest. We had a single mother. And yet Van made his choices. I made mine. Kwa made his. And my brother, or both my brothers, have made his. And until you've kind of witnessed that in your household and you understand how much that takes away from you, who doesn't do drugs, who isn't a problem, then you'll literally never understand. And I hope that you don't come at me for this. I hope that you're at least... You know, thank you, Felicity, for sharing, because most podcasters don't share stuff about their lives. And I kind of felt like I should in this instance, because it's Melbourne, it's heroin, and that's the fact of the matter. I don't know how to wrap that up now that I got all heated. Go to unknownpassagepodcast@gmail.com. Actually, don't go to that. Go to unknownpassagepodcast.com to go to the website. I will put up Van's episode page by tomorrow. Email, case suggestions, feedback. Please don't just rave at me like and be angry. If you don't like the way I'm doing it, make your own podcast. I like literally the number of people who I see like writing horrible comments and reviews on other podcasts, things. It's like, actually, I bet you don't have the balls or the inclination to do any research to do your own podcast. So maybe you do that. Leave a rating or review. I shouldn't say that after I've said that. If you like the show, if you have feedback on the show, please don't leave it as a review. If you have feedback, I don't even want to hear it, but email it if you get pissed off that I say, I don't care, please don't tell me. If you're pissed off that I start sentences with now, I don't fucking care, don't tell me. But yeah, and I rarely check that email anyway, so I'm sorry if I haven't got back to you on it. Become a patron, it links off the website. Also, just search Unknown Passage Podcast on the Patreon app. I will be changing it shortly. So what I'll do is anybody over a certain amount, I will allow to choose a location for an upcoming episode. So what's going to happen is I will, because people are still catching up with the show, I will pretty much say it for like 2 months so people have time to catch up. I'll say it on like every episode so they know, and then that will be the case. So I'm starting from now to say it so that people can catch up. Anybody up till now who's joined Patreon will get their location. Anybody who goes up until, what's the date today? So it's almost the 1st of May. Okay, so I'm going to make it the 1st of July. I will start this. Anybody who joins up to the 1st of July will get their location of choice no matter how much they pledge a month. But after the 1st of July, it will be anybody over basically €5, $5, whatever your currency is that you're doing it in, five. Because I'm getting like so many location requests from people joining Patreon, which is awesome. I just didn't think about this like when I started this podcast, that I never get time to do like my own cases unless I take a break. At the moment, like I'm caught up with it and stuff. But yeah, it's just the way it is, because I want to start doing a lot of my own cases. Nobody has like asked me why it's taking so long to do theirs or anything like that. I just want to allow it to be a perk for like over a certain amount, because quite a lot goes into researching these. As much as I love, you know, people leading where we go, it'll be over €5, dollars, whatever. So yeah, that's pretty much it. I've got Lorna coming up next. I'm going to try to get my friend Lorena on for that episode. She'll be fine. And then I've got Jamie Kay, I've got Stephen, and I'm going to try to get my friend Mark back on for that one because he likes that one. I've got Jessica, Laura, Amy, Paul, and Neil needs to supply me one. So they're all coming up. I hope that you've enjoyed this two-parter. I'm not going to feel bad for kind of saying what I've said about it, because I don't think most people have had an experience of having two siblings that are drug addicts. And I'm sorry that I don't sound sympathetic, but if you'd seen what I'd seen and gone through what I've gone through and missed out on what I've missed out, you would understand. So yeah, I will be back either. Yeah, I'll probably be back early next week. I'll probably be bringing this back to Tuesday like it is today. Okay, bye.